Thank you very much, Tom. I'm wondering if you would all stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Would you please join me in recognizing and welcoming the spouse of our guest, Annette Conway. Annette, nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming. You may recall we did this at an earlier meeting, but because of our speaker, I think a return seems appropriate. I have three questions to ask this audience. Rather than stand, just raise your hands if you would, please. Question number one, how many of us have served in World War II in the military? Raise your hands. Okay, keep your hands up if you would. Question two, how many in this audience have served in any military service during their life? Look at that. Oh, my God. Woo, woo. Okay, lower your hands. Last question. For those who have served, how many did so in the U.S. Marine Corps? Oh, that's great. Fabulous. I told you, Jim, you're among friends. General Conway graduated from Southeast Missouri State University and was commissioned in 1970 as an Army infantry officer. As an infantry officer. Oh, my God. I blew it right to the start. He commanded a battalion landing team during Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm and commanded a Marine Expeditionary Force during two combat tours in Iraq. He has received many decorations for his achievements and was appointed Commandant in November of 2006. The total number of members of the Marine Corps are about 200,000. Jim's job is similar to a CEO of a civilian corporation with the same number of employees. His decisions, however, can be life and death ones, literally. A civilian CEO has life and death decisions as well, but they only impact the bottom line. Just think of it. The context of these two types of decisions are enormous and must be worrisome. It is normal for many of us to feel that flag officers, generals and admirals, are rather full of themselves and their importance. Let me assure you, Jim Conway is not in this camp at all. As those of you who have talked with him, he is warm, gracious, enjoys a good laugh, very personable. It just shows you can be nice as well as being a superb leader. Jim has influenced his family with two sons in the Corps, one a battalion commander and the other in special ops. Also, his daughter is married to a Marine Cobra pilot. I guess if I were in the Corps, I wouldn't feel at a disadvantage to have a father or father-in-law as commandant. In fact, I guess I'm too old to change my name to Conway and re-enlist in the Marine Corps. Founded in 1775, the Marines, more than any other force, have displayed in locations around the world the strength, honor, courage, and commitment that has kept our nation free. They are America's 911. I saw our Defense Department head didn't think that was appropriate, but I look at them as America's 911, immediately responsible any place in the world. They are an elite force, and we owe them a great debt of gratitude for their sacrifices on behalf of our nation. So on behalf of their leader, it is my honor to introduce to the Forum Club the 34th Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, General James T. Conway. Sepper fee, high. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you, Tom, for that warm introduction. My mother would be delighted with that introduction. My mother-in-law would still be skeptical, but that's another story. Well, folks, it's great to be with you today. Thanks to the invitation committee and to the president of the outfit for the opportunity for Annette and me to be with you here in Naples. Any duty outside of D.C. is great duty, but when you come to Naples, Florida in February, it probably doesn't get any better than that. We were talking at the reception before we stepped in, and someone asked me, how's retirement going? And the answer is pretty good. I will admit that my beautiful wife and I have undergone marriage counseling since I retired. Married for 43 years, but we saw a need to go see the psych, and she immediately threw me under the bus. I mean, she said, "Doc, you know, he doesn't listen to me anymore. He thinks the things that I think are important aren't so important." And I get the impression sometimes he'd just rather be with his buddies than be with me. So with that, this young doctor behind the desk stepped out from behind, bent my beautiful wife over the back of her chair, and gave her a powerful kiss. And he said, "And that, sir, is what your wife needs about 3 times a week. So I kind of grimaced, and I said, "Okay, Doc, I can bring her by on Monday and Wednesday, right? But on Fridays, I'm fishing with my buddies, you know, so we got to work this out." I'm kidding, of course. Folks, I'm here today to talk about international affairs. That's what Tom asked me to speak about, and I want to do that. And the way I'd like to phrase my comments to you over the next 25 minutes or so is in terms of what I perceive to be the 5 greatest threats that our nation faces. And I think to give that discussion proper context, what I'd first like to do is talk to you about a study I had commissioned as a commandant when I got ready to turn it over to my successor. I called about 6 of our bright young minds out of Quantico, Virginia, our development education center. And I put these guys to work and I said, "Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go out to academia, to the think tanks, to business and government. We're going to send you overseas for a short while to talk to some European nations. And I want you to answer 4 questions for me. Okay, first of all, what's the world going to look like in the period 2020 to 2025? If we go further out than that, we're guessing. If we go shorter than that, we may not be able to influence some fairly expensive programs. And in the end, this is about equipment and shaping our core. Second question, what's going to be the involvement of the United States of America in that world in 2020 to 2025? How does the Department of Defense, question number 3, support the United States in our efforts? And lastly, what should our Marine Corps look like as a part of that department?" So if you go about trying to answer those questions, that's going to be very helpful to us as an institution, and they did. And I was very happy with their study. They came back with a fairly thick document, probably a quarter and a half inch thick, with a couple of pages of findings, if you will. And I will share with you folks today, again, just to sort of preset our conversation, with about 4 or 5 of those. Okay. First, they said that the people of the world are moving. They're increasing, of course, in numbers, as you all know, but people are moving towards the water. They're moving towards the coastlines. And by about 2025, fully 75% of the world's population will live adjacent to water in some form or fashion. Not in huge glass and steel buildings, but more in what they call urban slums, which makes them ripe, potentially, for insurgencies and those manner of things, because they're not going to have a lot in many, many instances. They said that the demographics are changing, that the industrialized nations are, on average, getting older, the non-industrialized are getting younger, and a large percentage of those young people do not have jobs. Once again, sowing some potential seeds for unrest. They said that there are silent migrations taking place into Europe and arguably the United States that the governments are reacting to in a relatively belated fashion, and that those migrations are changing the face of the average voter in those nations, so that the countries we learned about in school may not be the same countries that exist today, and they may see things a little differently from old school Europe or even parts of South America. So we need to take that into consideration. They said that there will probably be regional conflict, but that the probability of a major peer war, say the United States and China, is not likely. Could still happen, but is not likely. But that some of those regional conflicts could get very hot, could even escalate to nuclear confrontation, depending upon the nations involved. They said that oil will continue to be a very necessary product, especially again with the industrialized nations, even by 2025, that there will be attempts at alternative fuel, but they'll be expensive, and they'll be partially successful, and what we're going to need is a continued reliance on oil to grease the engines and the gears of industry, but that by 2025, water will be as important as oil. That today, about 40% of the nations on the globe are experiencing a level of deprivation of fresh water supply. And, of course, water is a basic human need. So countries will flat be prepared to go to war to protect their water source if it's threatened by some nation upstream. And the last one I'd offer today for our discussion again is that by 2025, the world will no longer be principally a single polar world. In other words, our country has been the real superpower since the fall of the wall, 1989-1990. By 2025, that will have changed. And a number more powers will be on the scene. Okay, certainly Russia has always been there, but a resurgent Russia with oil and gas is better than they were even a decade ago. The combined effects of Europe, China, we know, is a burgeoning economic giant and only getting stronger. And the new player on the scene is India. And her point to us was, we're going to have to learn how to deal with that. It will be different from what we have experienced. And our nation is going to have to adjust to that and make decisions accordingly. So I thought a pretty interesting study, and one, again, that would set the basis for our discussion today. The five threats that I see facing our great nation start with Islamic extremism. We have battled it now for something over 10 years. We're about to stand down from our perspective in Afghanistan come the close of 2014. But the fact is, if you are subject to discussion that Al-Qaeda is dead, it reminds you of the Will Rogers line, my demise has been much exaggerated of late, okay, because that is frankly not true. Now, Al-Qaeda, I will say, you know, the number three job in Al-Qaeda was probably the most dangerous job in the world because of our drone capability, and I'll check that block. Because of our drone capability, the life expectancy in that job was about 6 months. And there's goodness in that because that's normally their overseas operational planner. But we have found it's a very resilient organization. And we've identified what we see as squirters, people going to Yemen, to Somalia, to the Trans-Sahel Africa region, and looking for those, quote, ungoverned spaces where they can, again, set down their roots and start to become a cancer on some of those societies. A gentleman that spoke to you previously, General John Abizade, when he was on active duty, had his staff pull down off the internet the strategy for Islamic extremism. And I'd like to share that with you today and ask you where you think they are. Their strategy had four or five steps. The first step was to declare jihad and have all the brothers respond. Well, they've done that. But they've only been partially successful there, I think. There are the extremists, but thankfully, from our perspective, they're relatively small in number based on the scope of the entire population. They want to establish the old caliphate, the Middle East, if you will, that they knew when Islam ruled major portions of the world. They want to exorcise Western influence from the region. They will do that, they think, not through defeating any forces in the field. They realize they can't field armies or forces sufficient to do that, but they think that they can do it through bankrupting the Western or the industrialized countries through control of the oil supply, either by attacking refineries, taking over countries that do major exportation, those types of things. They think they can bring us to our knees and limit our ability to respond to threats in that region. By, again, using our own oil against us. In that process, they see a certain requirement as the destruction of Israel, literally wiping Israel off the map and all that it represents in terms of the impact on the Middle East. They would see a continuation of terrorist attacks in the West, again, in an effort to try to make sure that we continue to spend billions annually on defense, trying to defend everywhere. And they say, ladies and gentlemen, if it takes 100 years, so be it. There's an old expression in Afghanistan, you have the watches, but we have the time. And that's the mentality here that's at work, I think, unfortunately, in Islamic extremism. So where are we today? Well, we will soon be out of Afghanistan, 2014. Unfortunately, I think that the leadership of those organizations will be able to say, well, ladies and gentlemen, in 25 years, we defeated the Soviet Union and America, the two strongest countries in the world. That, they believe, will bring money and recruitment. Also, something that concerns me a good bit is that when we leave Afghanistan, Pakistan will be the last man standing in the region against extremism. 2009, Pakistan declared for the first time in decades that their greatest national threat was not India, but it was Islamic extremism. Folks, Pakistan has something over 100 nuclear weapons. Pakistan is the closest nexus of terrorism and nuclear weapons. God forbid that they should fall on hard times or that the insurgents, the extremists, again, should see fit to one day be able to march on Islamabad and take charge of those weapons. Secondly is Iran. Iran really on two counts in my mind. One, because by virtue of fate and geography, they sit astride one of the two or three most critical straits in the world. Each day, 20% of the nation's flow of oil passes through the Straits of Hormuz. They're under great pressure today from major nations in the world, and they have few options in terms of response, but one of those options could be to shut down temporarily or for as long as their military could hold up the Straits of Hormuz. If you think back to what a 2% reduction in oil supply did during the Libyan crisis, you get a feel for what 20% could do in terms of global economy. So I think we always need to be mindful of that. Secondly, though, and more disconcerting from my perspective, is their headlong effort to gain a nuclear weapons capability. Now, the Iranians have said for years, we don't want nuclear weapons. What we want are nuclear power plants. Well, I'm sorry. That sounds to me like the Eskimos needing refrigerators, okay? It doesn't quite wash. Yet that's been their claim, and some people have bought it for years. But today, you have 33 nations, and now the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying, nope, what they're doing goes well beyond what would be necessary for nuclear power plants. And so that threat is there. Now, so what are our options? Well, I think there are three or four. One are sanctions, which, again, the United States and a number of nations have in place right now. Okay. Secondly, is I suppose you could launch military attack, two types of attack here. You could do limited attack with aircraft and maybe ships. But the problem there is you cannot destroy the capability. You can delay it. Estimates range as high as 18 months of delay. But if they retain the will, and my suggestion to you is at that point we will simply have poked the tiger and the will would certainly be there, it's only going to come back at you. How about a full-scale attack? Well, if you check the geography again, Tehran is a long way from anywhere. With a couple of mountain ranges in between any landing beaches and the ability to go to Tehran and do regime changeout. So once again, a relatively difficult course of action. You can look at containment, such as we did with the Soviet Union and their nuclear weapons. And I suppose that's an option. Much less bloody, potentially, than these possibilities for attack, but an option. The drawback there is, one, it violates what our nation has said now for a number of years, and so we would suffer a certain credibility gap and a perceptive loss of power in the eyes of the rest of the world. But secondly, what you're telling other nations is you've got to do more. So you potentially have Turkey, Saudi Arabia, even Egypt in the Middle East saying, well, we can't allow such a power imbalance, so maybe we need to have nuclear weapons as well. So not necessarily a good option in the scheme of things. A fourth option is what I would call change from within. And that is the Iraqi people, fed up as they are already with their government, simply makes the necessary changes to try to bring a more representative government to bear. The problem I see is that we probably missed an opportunity to support that in 2009. There was a movement in the streets. We were mum on the issue, as was the rest of the world, really. A lot of those people have paid the price, and that movement is much diminished now compared to what it used to be. So no good options on Iran at this point, and that's why it's a tough problem for this president and certainly for our country. The wild card in it all is Israel. A nation will do what's in their best interest to do. There could be an opportunity here. The Israelis would say a requirement, an existential threat that would cause them to attack. Our problem in all of that is that they will be flying American weapons, dropping American bombs. And whether or not we have acquiesced to the idea or supported the move will be perceived by, I think, the rest of the Muslim world as having done so. And I can't tell you how that plays out. I did have a fairly negative review from an Israeli officer in Washington, but I'll keep that close because I think there's some media here today and we probably shouldn't talk about it. But things escalate at a fairly rapid pace, and I don't see any good end to it. Threat number three, China. You would like to think that major economic powers, ours is the strongest economy today, Chinese are closely behind us, they will surpass us by all projections in 2020. You'd think that countries who deal economically on such a successful level as we do would never see a need to go to conflict. And we hope that continues to be the case. They have great trading relations, again, with the Koreans, the Japanese, Australians, and so forth in their own region. However, there are some things that I see taking place in China that give us cause for concern. One of those is that we visited China about 3 years ago now, and a young Army brigadier in the office there, the State Department, in the embassy, had a conversation with us, and he said, you know, you need to understand the culture. The culture is such that they don't believe in win-win, okay? In China, you have winners and you have losers. Now, they're smart enough to know that we believe in it, and most of the industrialized world believes in it. They studied it. They use it in their terminologies. But down deep, it's not in their soul. Okay, you've got winners and you've got losers. And if you doubt that, General, go find a Chinese traffic jam and see if you see anybody backing out. Okay, because they won't do it. The moment they put their vehicle in reverse, they have lost face with the other people sitting there patiently to endure that traffic jam. Kind of a practical example, but made sense. So that's my first concern. Secondly, In traditional societies, your politicians can be aggressive-minded and they can be a little bit provocative, but traditionally, your generals and admirals are more laid back. They are reluctant to commit troops because they know what it means. The reverse of that is taking place right now, folks, in China. The most bellicose people in the government are the generals and the admirals. And I see that as a little bit troubling, because they not only have the power, they're advocating the use of power. And you're seeing it somewhat in some of these island disputes with the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the Filipinos, and the Japanese. And frankly, I think the last time I've seen it this pronounced was probably Japan before World War II, when their admirals and generals also advocated the use of their force to accomplish national aim. China has always been a regional power. And you would have to be foolish to take on a 5-million-man Chinese army on the mainland. But they have not until recently had a power projection capability. And now they do. There was a time 15 years ago they couldn't even get their army from the mainland out to Taiwan. So threats against that island were primarily long-range stuff. Those days have changed. Today, China has a very capable expeditionary force. They have landing gear that the United States Marine Corps doesn't have, and they're developing a blue water fleet to include carriers. So the idea of China not being able to project its power is a thing of the past. And so our concerns have to transcend just the region. And the last thing, and I'm almost reluctant to raise it, but I've read some thoughts by Chinese, some of them generals and admirals, some of them Chinese academics. And they would tell you that their worldview is that over the last 400 or 500 years, Westerners, read Caucasians, have exercised a level of domination in our world. They would say we generally screwed it up. Okay, now it's time for a resurgence of people of Chinese or Oriental extraction to have that opportunity to lead. We don't like to think of race wars or those kinds of thoughts behind national objectives, but I lay it out to you for what it is. Now, if I was a Chinese general and I was advising my leadership, would I recommend conflict with the United States? No, I would not. What I would recommend is that you don't fight the United States forces. You engage the United States image. Because remember, it's all about face. And if they can somehow diminish our power or perceptions of power in their universe, which again, at this point, is the Pacific region, they will accomplish a great deal. If they can construct local tactical scenarios where they have an overwhelming advantage over U.S. forces that are normally seen to be everywhere and all-powerful, they can get to the minds of those leaders in the Pacific Rim. I can name you the countries, but you know them as well as I do, and in turn make them decide, okay, which way do we provide our allegiance here? We'll see, but I have a prediction there that sometime in the not-too-distant future you may see some of those tactical scenarios come to pass. Concern number four, the national fiscal crisis. I'll give you just a few of the statistics. Okay, today we have a deficit in excess, a national debt in excess of $16 trillion. Okay, we have an annual deficit for the last 5 years over $1 trillion, adding to that overall debt that the country has. Today, as we sit and stand here, 73% of our gross domestic product is matched by this national debt. We apply each year about 6% of our revenues against our national debt, 6%. The only thing that exceeds that in the scheme of things is Medicaid, Medicare, and the Department of Defense. It doubles the education budget. And yet, folks, we're only paying the interest. We're not touching the principal of that debt. So it only continues to grow as we conduct our deficit spending. You can't have a military power that is not also an economic power sufficient to support your needs. And that's what we see happening today, unfortunately. Is a military, in the wake of our wars, in the face of some fairly significant spending to put us back upright and prepared, that is going to be seeing much less in terms of resources to do what has to be done. Historically, we've run about 4% of the GDP on an annual basis, except when we were at war. During World War II, it was in excess of 50%. Korea, 13%. Vietnam, 9%. We stayed at about 4% over these last 10 years. With Iraq and Afghanistan, just slightly more than that. We see a Department of Defense budget going to somewhere 3% or below. And so we have to ask ourselves as a nation, is that what we want? Because other nations are going to make decisions. We have a lot of partners and allies, and partly it's because they agree with us, partly it's because they want to be associated with the most powerful nation on earth. And if we lose that brand, then I think we stand to lose allies and partners with some of the things that we might endeavor to accomplish in years to come. You know, it's very complicated, and when I think about it, I try to distill it down to the individual household. Okay? If in your home you are spending more than you budget each year, okay, it's not really a budget, is it? I mean, it's a wish and a prayer. If you have a huge debt, say you're home or whatever, that's fine. But if you're only paying against the interest every year, your debt never goes away. And so at some point, you've got to get after that. And I don't know how it is in your families, but in my families on both sides, the worst thing a household member can do is pass on a huge debt to your children. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly where we are today. The last thing I would reference to you is our overdependence, I would say, on foreign oil. Now, let me say in the same phrase, it's getting better, Okay, but today it is still a problem. The United States consumes on an annual basis about 24% of the world's resources, and we have about 5% of the nation's of the world's population. We haul 19 plus million gallons of oil into the country every year. Today, we have a requirement for import of about 45% of that. Now, that's significant in a country of our strength and power again. It represents a sort of a critical vulnerability. Now, let me say that, you know, that oil is largely going to a world market. In a period of crisis, we could stop those gates and we'd have the oil we need to get ourselves out of an emergency. But that's not the way the global economy generally works. The oil economy is not a free economy. The top 10 oil companies in the world, 7 of them are state-owned. So it's not free enterprise, such as we see at work here on the streets of the United States. We have a tremendous transfer of wealth out of our country annually to pay for this import. About $385 billion last year of American money going someplace else in the world. About $80 billion each year for the United States, Navy, Marine Corps, Army, and Air Force, to protect vital straits to ensure free flow of commerce. That's money potentially that could be spent otherwise. And again, from a perspective, we really need to do that. Now, okay, so how do we fix it? Well, I think that we must have a national strategic energy plan. Now, I emphasize the word plan, not policy. Policies live as long as the policymakers in office. Okay, what we need is a plan that will carry us through the next 20 or 30 years to take a look at how we use these resources and what our energy plan says is going to be best for this nation to avoid the transfer of wealth and be much more self-dependent. Okay, so those are the five. Now, I didn't mention Russia, okay, who, never forget this, folks, could destroy us overnight. Only nation in the world that if it started punching buttons could destroy our way of life tonight. Okay? I didn't mention cyber warfare, which some would argue we're engaged with on a major scale with China right now. They're stealing our secrets. We're stealing theirs. The only goodness in that is that, you know, our capability is as good, maybe a little better even than theirs. A gentleman before we came in talked about education. Our education in this country is not what it needs to be to produce the great young scholars like you saw stand up here earlier today, and it needs to get there. I didn't mention global warming or asteroid strikes, okay, depending upon your, you know, view. All those things are within the state of the art, but there are other considerations out there that some of you might alter the list to read. I want to leave you on a positive note, okay, because there are some pluses as we look at these challenges downrange. One, with regard to Islamic extremism, I honestly think that this Arab Spring that's taking place has potential. Okay, if we get at the root cause of the unhappiness, maybe we can do more. And if we start to see representative-style governments in some of these countries in the Middle East, maybe, just maybe, there's a solution set here to what appears otherwise to be a long-term problem. Iran. I saw just the other day, it's unclassified, an Israeli estimate that says that they really won't have a weapon until 2016. I would have said previously, folks, this summer we've got a major issue with the potential for an Israeli strike. If they think it's going to be that long, that buys us time. And who knows what can happen in the next 2.5, 3.5 years. Okay? China. In an intriguing sort of way, China is driving our partners and allies in the Pacific even closer to us. They're expanding on their defense budgets because they don't like the horizon they see either. And they're coming closer to us, and some of the ankle biters aren't such a big deal anymore because they do want to stay close to the United States of America. In terms of the fiscal crisis, the one ray of hope that I see in all of this is that our countrymen now get it. There's a recent poll out there that says 84% of the people in our country think that we are spending too much. And hopefully this will start to register with our politicians, and we'll see a reaction to that thought process in some of the bills and laws that are proposed and hopefully passed. And lastly, again, I would argue with little thanks to the government, our recent boon in energy production is a marvelous thing. Could take care in some ways of some of the other problems that we face with regard to the economy and jobs self-sufficiency and those types of things. But again, it's a valuable resource. I don't think we can just we can ease into it and not know what we're doing. So again, I emphasize the importance of a national energy plan. Okay, before I go to questions, I would like to do one thing. Great to see all the veterans in the audience today. How many Navy guys do we have in here? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for your service, and it's an honor to be with you today. I do want to dispel a myth, okay? And that is that somehow when a Marine becomes a general officer, he stops telling stories on the Navy, okay? Nothing could be further from the truth, all right? So I'm going to share one with you before I step down and Tom gets his questions lined up here. We had a gunnery sergeant who retired from the service not too long ago, and the gunny had always wanted to open a pet store, and so he did. And this young gentleman walked by the gunny store one day, and he had a sign in the window that said, "Talking dog for sale." So the guy was really intrigued. He walked in and said, "Hey, gunny, where's this talking dog that you're advertising?" And the gunny says, "He's right there." And he looks, and there's a yellow mongrel-looking dog sitting there on his haunches looking at both of them. So the guy's going to play along, and he says, "How did you learn to speak?" And the dog says, "Well, I was in the Marine Corps, in a reconnaissance unit." And the guy's just shaking his head. He said, "Yeah, they liked me. They realized I was pretty intelligent, so they taught me the language. And we would use it. I mean, I would go out and find bad guys, listen to them talk, come back and report. We must have killed 100 bad guys like that." And the guy's just backing away. And the dog continues. He said, "Yeah, but I left the Marine Corps. I got tired of the deployments, dog ears and all those things. So I joined the FBI. He said, "They would do a lot the same thing. They would have me hang out around phone booths or walk into hotel lobbies. I'd listen up. We must have rolled up 25 spies like that." And the guy turns to the gunny and says, "Holy cow, I got to have this dog. How much?" And the gunny says, $10. The guy says, $10? He's a talking dog. He's a national hero." And the gunny says, "That's the problem." He says, "The dog is such a bullshitter." He didn't do any of that stuff. He was in the Navy.
Would you speak for, would you ask questions, answer questions for another 5 minutes?
Oh, yeah, sure, sure. I'm on you.
I just, I thank you, Jim. Thank you, General Conway, for being here. Let me give you a couple of books to remind you of your trip to Collier County and to Naples, and I'll put them right here on your chair.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much. And as I got up, Jim has agreed to spend, because we're running a little bit late, an extra maybe 5 minutes answering questions. I know some of you have to go to back to work and to other things, but he's going to speak until about 25 of. So thanks.
I don't think speaking to 25 up will give us enough time. There are a ton of them here. Let's start with the students. How do you feel about South America and even the areas of Africa we are not hearing about today? How will they contribute to the changes expected by 2020 to 2025?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, if you look at growth, and I'm going to answer fairly rapid fire because you got a lot of questions, and I'll try to get to as many as I can. If you look at growth, there are some countries in South America, in particular Brazil, that are just gangbusters. And I think, as opposed to the old sort of military junta types of governments that we used to see, they're past that. Okay, the internet is doing wonderful things across the globe. And these people see a lifestyle that they like, they're working hard for it, and they're making great gains. Africa has more problems, I think, at this point than South America, just in terms of an educated workforce, honest governments that are free of corruption and those types of things. But once again, you've got a lot of people working to help them out, not least the Chinese, and so I think you're going to see some great gains there as well.
A second one from our students. How do the surrounding nations of Iran feel about the nuclear activity taking place or the threat of that?
They are scared to death. They are petrified. Okay, when I first went to the Middle East in 1986, I was traveling with the Admiral William Crow, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that point. And every nation gave us a brief in the Gulf Cooperation Council. Every nation's largest threat was Iran. And so they simply don't trust them. And any talk of nuclear weapons just sends them spiraling right through the overhead. They're scared to death.
They are not a lot of questions about sequestration. Please comment on if, in fact, that whole program goes through. What will that do to the capability of the military?
Yeah.
The enormous decreases in defense spending.
Well, they are enormous, and I think it very quickly gets us on that declining path to much less resource and much less capability. I think that you're probably, if it happens, and every indication at this point is that it's going to, you're going to see even smaller numbers of in-state and services. I think you'll see larger numbers of Marines, larger numbers of Army being taken off the rosters. You're going to see a Navy that's the smallest since World War I, at a time when we're ostensibly transferring our greater concerns to the Pacific. If you're going to go to the Pacific, you have to understand the time and spatial requirements associated with that theater. And if you're going to go there in earnest fashion and try to do as much as we have in the past, you need more ships and more airplanes. So the Navy and the Air Force ought to be looking at plus-ups, and yet if you check the roster, there are none. So I'm concerned that sequester is going to be a hard pill to swallow. And again, folks, if we get serious about doing something about our national debt, I think it even goes beyond sequester. So when we get into those discussions, we've got to ask ourselves what's important. If we're thinking about the household again, how much insurance do we need to have? Has to be some risk, I got that. Defense has to pay a portion, I got that. But not at the expense of stripping this nation away from its, I think, superpower status.
There are a lot of questions about Benghazi. Was there a cover-up? Should, in your view, the military or other entities been able to respond in a timely fashion to avoid the deaths? What is your opinion of that? And there was a question here, did the four-star generals know about this thing in advance, this potential attack in advance?
Yep. Folks, what you heard, if you read about testimony yesterday on the part of Secretary Panetta and Marty Dempsey, I think is accurate. If you don't have a force prepared to go, and you have an emergency that's happening as you speak, your response is going to be delayed. So I accept that they could not get Marines or Special Forces or aviation over the target in sufficient time to help those people out in the firefight. But the point is, there should have been preparation, in my mind, for some of those types of things based upon the calls that the ambassador repeatedly put forward. You know, ambassadors just don't ring that bell unless they have to. It's like declaring a safety issue if you're Marine Aviation. It's a very carefully chosen word. And when an ambassador is saying, I've got a security problem, the entire State Department is reading that cable, and there should be an appropriate response, I think, that prevents an incident from taking place as opposed to trying to respond to it militarily after it's underway.
Would you describe the excuse that the government gave us about this film amounted to a cover-up as opposed to a terrorist attack at Benghazi?
I'm sorry, as a citizen, I'm as stunned as you that we heard that in the vernacular, in the discussions, on the talk shows for as long as we did, when it was clear from almost the very outset that that was not at work. So I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
What is your view of the Secretary of Defense prospect of Senator Hagel to take over the defense?
Yeah. I don't know Senator Hagel.
Where's this transformation? Where's this open window you keep talking about? You don't want to comment on that?
Well, I respect the fact. I like the fact that he was an Army veteran out of Vietnam. It's not a requirement for the job, but every once in a while, I think it's good to have that happen. I think, will bring a certain perspective on what it takes to serve. He was an enlisted man, not even an officer. So I think that's a perspective that the department can use on a rotational basis.
There are a number of questions about drones and their impact. And the fact that
significant impact.
Yeah, like death. And therefore, we're not able to obtain intelligence information when these people die and what have you. What's your view on this whole drone matter?
Yeah. Well, drones are a very effective tool. Where you have safe haven, such as we have in the Pakistani mountains opposite our fighting forces in Afghanistan, And quite frankly, I'll speak for the Pakistanis to say that they duck protest too loudly sometimes, okay? Because in fact, they'd like to see that problem go away too. Now, you got to be precise, and that's the nature of a drone attack, is it is precise. And we don't always know when we get the bad guy, but, you know, if he's there, we've got the camera action and so forth. When that place goes into 1,000 pieces, they normally go with it. So the beauty of it is it's kind of like a sniper. It's a precision attack, and you avoid collateral damage, and yet you do a great deal of damage if your intelligence is good against your sought-out target.
When you were in office, how would you describe your relationship with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and the President of the United States?
Yeah.
In 30 seconds or left.
It was a very professional relationship. quite frankly, I'll be honest with you, my wife and I have had this conversation. The smartest thing that I did when I became commandant was slap the table and say, this is my last job. Okay, I didn't care about being an ambassador. I didn't want to go be somebody else. Didn't want to be the chairman. My devotion was to the United States Marine Corps and what was best for my institution. So your responsibility, you're the commandant, but you're also one of the six members of the JCS. Your responsibility as a part of the JCS is to give your best military advice as it relates to your service and the others to the secretary and the president. And so I was very able to do that. And I tell you, it wasn't always what they wanted to hear. But that's okay. My conscience was clear. That is what I believed after 40 years of experience was best for our nation to move forward. You can take it or leave it. Doesn't hurt my feelings either way. But the fact is, I was doing my job when I offered that recommendation in terms of how we ought to proceed.
What is your view about women in combat?
Well, so long as we do not change the standard for women in combat units, I think we'll be okay. But what needs to be the major portion of the discussion is how do we enhance our combat units, not how do we offer opportunity for people. And as we spoke at the table, I think there's a misperception out there that if you start to have women in the combat units, they're automatically going to make general officer. That's not a quid pro quo, okay? I would offer few women that I think will be able to get into the combat ranks are going to be in there against some real meat eaters. And it's still a very competitive environment, okay? How many people here in the national championship game saw women on the field? Okay? Some of those same men are going to be officers in the Army and the Marine Corps and the other services. It's a very competitive environment. So to think that, simply because they make that first cut, they're one day going to be, a 3 or 4-star general admiral, doesn't necessarily follow.
There are a number of questions about cyber attacks, our vulnerability, the aggressiveness of some countries like China. How do you view those as they impact our ability to defend ourselves?
Yeah. I think the threat is increasingly severe. The nations who are attacking us, and I consider them to be China, Iran, and Russia in sort of the top tier, are getting into our government at the unclassified level. That includes the military. They're getting into our business. They're getting into our medicine. I think any sort of trade secret that we think helps us with a competitive edge, you better protect it, or these people are going to find a way to get after it. And the problem is you won't know they've been there. So it's very severe to the point where they could cause calamity and loss of life, I think is not beyond question if you interfere with certain control systems in the country. So it's something that needs to be taken very, very seriously.
The book The Generals by Thomas Reeks speaks poorly of General Franks and General Sanchez. What is your opinion?
Yeah. I worked for Tommy Franks. I enjoyed working for him. He's a very ebullient, frankly spoken, charismatic leader. When he came to visit my forces and my Marines, after he finished speaking, he waded right out in the middle of them and shake hands and slap backs and hug people, and that endeared me to him in a combat environment. Rick Sanchez had a tough go with the State Department team, the leadership team that was in Baghdad at the time. I think he tried to represent military interest to the best of his ability, but it was a tough slog.
Now that we have a new Secretary of State, Senator Kerry, how do you feel that organization will operate relative to the defense industry or defense people?
Yeah. Well, once again, Kerry is a veteran of Vietnam. I think he has a strong understanding for defense. It's critically important as you watch national-level decisions being made that the Secretary of the Department of Defense and the Secretary of State are in common cause. We had that, frankly, quite a lot with Secretary Clinton and Dr. Gates when I was in the job. And I think it's very helpful for Kerry to come with a pretty strong understanding already of the importance and the capabilities or the lack of capability of military force.
Syria. We read this morning in the Wall Street Journal that I guess Obama limited our engagement there.
Sure.
What do you feel we should have done or should do in that country?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you my honest opinion without benefit of the classified information. I'm sure that was available. I was not in the office when Syria fired up. But I think if we had had the proper intelligence to determine long range now who are going to be our friends and who are going to oppose us, and what's the probability in the rebel force of one or the other rising to consequence, you gain an immense amount of credibility when you support a winner. And that winner is a person or is a leadership team that believes in representative government. So there's a number of steps there, but I would certainly not have ruled out any involvement whatsoever, because if those people now do come to power, how are they going to view the United States and our lack of taking any position, really, as we sat on the sidelines?
This is our last question. He didn't sign it, so if I'm going to suggest he come forward. I have signed personalized photographs from General Vandergift, Kate Gates, and Shepard. May I have yours? I would say you probably can, but you have to come forward. I don't know who you are.
So. I know who he is. I'm Adam. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jim, for those great remarks.
Good questions.
Well, they were good questions. Nicely done.
Okay. Does that answer the mail?
Nicely done, yep.
All right, sure. Yeah, that's it.